What is it?
The main thing I got from it was like this sense of feeling seen and validated.
Well, why does it have to be this way?
This book was placed in my hand for this moment.
Insightful, learned a lot, wrote some quotes that I'm ready to like paint on my wall.
I love this book!
That we just kind of pull out some of the big themes that we see and talk about a few different ones.
I apologize if most of my contribution has K-pop references.
Alternative book title, The Feminine Mystique Part 2. You were really just gay all along.
Welcome to Book Club
with Julia
and Victoria,
two people who could not be more delighted to be reading an entire book about indexes.
Yes.
And we'd love to be your book friends.
This is a podcast for the books that we just can't shut up about.
This week, we're talking about Index, A History of the... You get it? Because the title's written like it would be in an index. LOL.
Love it.
All I can imagine with that title is the poor, like, publishing intern who had to, like, organize it in the database because publishing databases are written like indexes. And so would they have tried to, like, rearrange it to, like...
A history of the index.
So they would have they done history of the, comma, index, comma, or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, comma, index, comma, something like that. To, like, would it automatically do that? Or they saw that title and assumed that the actual title was A History of the Index and undid the joke when they moved it away from the database. Anyway, I spent a good long time imagining how to process this novel. I'm getting ahead of myself.
What is the subtitle of this novel? Or this, not novel. What's the subtitle of this book?
The subtitle is A Bookish Adventure from Medieval Manuscripts to the Digital Age by Dennis Duncan, our good friend Duncan. So get ready for some incredibly nerdy Western European literary history. If my diatribe about the publishing industry tickled you in any way, this is the right episode for you.
You know, often we try to do intros that are, like, super engaging. Like, what is going to hook you in? This one is just weeding you out.
Yeah.
It's just like, did that interest you? Then we've got a book for you. If you're like, I could not care less, then catch us on another episode. But I think this one's going to be great. Also, fun. There are no spoilers because it is history, friends, that we are talking about. No plot lines to be spoiled.
So some surprises. Of things that have already happened.
Those are some surprises.
That you may not have known about.
Yeah. And whether you've read it or not, you're welcome here at the party. We will talk about our favorite parts of the book, but we will not get to all of it. So it's still worth the read if you enjoy the conversation and want more.
Yeah. You too can have the experience of trying to decipher his Middle English quotations.
Dear God.
Take you right back to senior year of high school or college.
I was like, you were reading Middle English in high school?
Some people read Chaucer senior year.
Oh, okay.
If you'd like to support the show, you can rate, review, and subscribe on your podcast platform that you're listening to right now. Leave us a question on Spotify. We'd love to answer those. Send us book recs. If you go down to any of the book links in our show notes, that will take you to our bookshop.org affiliate page where we get a very small kickback if you purchase on that page. And if you want to go to, I'm doing such a bad job. My brain is gone, Victoria.
We're recording this like 5 hours later than we typically do. So buckle up, friends. I think Julia was also going to share that we have a Buy Me a Coffee. You can buy us coffee. Just kidding. You become a member. We give you fun content. BuyMeACoffee.com/bookclubwithJB.
Yeah, thank you.
I got you, girl. So what was your experience reading this book? You brought it to the table. You told me about it. I got very excited when you did. How did it come into your life?
I mean, it's a bright yellow cover, so it was hard to miss. I genuinely think it was the last time, like when I visited Seattle and we were at a bookstore and I saw it and I was like, oh my God, I need to get this for Victoria. A year and a half passes, longer probably, and I finally got around to buying it at like a big book haul, I think when I got Southern Book Club, and I really confused the bookseller because like saying Index, A History of the out loud sounds like another language. And they were like, what are you talking about right now? But I got it. And I was like, I'll read it first and then I'll give it to her, like classic Julie and Victoria book gifting, and it'll be fun. I did not expect to like love it. I was so pleasantly surprised and was not really prepared for how tied the index is to like every single piece mm-hmm. of like communication and information technology that exists now. Like, it's not just a history of the index, it's like a history of like reading, Western philosophy, communication. Like, it just, it generated so many ideas in my brain that connected to even parts of my thesis. Like, we're gonna throw some anthropology in here, folks. Like, I had a lot of fun, but this, you are the exact target audience of this book in a way that I am like slightly left of center in terms of the target audience. I've like, if you're the bullseye, I'm like 8 or 9. So what did you think?
I was very excited when you told me about it. I was like, yes, I will read it. Yes. Okay. Like, we were, I don't even think we were talking about doing it on the podcast. We were just like, this will be fun for us, mm-hmm. mainly for me. And you were like, I'll be a good sport. And then we were like, wait, this is a very fun book. I love the quirky histories on very particular topics in general. And especially if that topic is within the realm of books and reading, I'm like even more excited. Yeah, Dennis Duncan's book did not disappoint. And I found it very, or I would say relatively easy to read and thoroughly interesting. I thought it was like a great deep dive in some areas. And then other times, like obviously Duncan is doing work to condense his years of research into a really accessible general reader nonfiction book. And I thought that was like very well done, where we could like deep dive and like, here's the tea. And let's talk about these two authors in the 19th century who had a beef. And it's really fun and how that plays into the history of the index. It was also always a delight to read an annotated copy that you've sent me with all your little notes. It's like we read it together.
Yeah.
For some listeners, you might have caught this on previous episodes, but I don't know if I've talked about it at length. I have a deep fascination with the post office. And I... My internal monologue, when I first, I cheated a little bit. I went to the bookstore and read the introduction when Julia still had the book, because I just really wanted to like get excited about it. Mm-hmm. And my first thought was like, oh my gosh, I could be an indexer. Like, I've always dreamed this little childhood dream of mine that maybe I would go sort the mail someday, which I realize they have machines for. Yes, I understand. Mm-hmm. I understand the great people at the postal office aren't necessarily standing there sorting things day in
by
and day
hand.
Out, but I wanted to sort. I enjoy sorting things into categories. And when I realized that there are human beings that are professional indexers that really are not too far off from the field that I work in already, mm-hmm. I was like, it could be me.
It could be you.
I immediately did a deep dive. I hadn't even read the book, and I was like texting Julia, like, I could be an indexer. Oh my gosh. And she, without prompting, was like, it makes sense for you. It's kind of like the post office of words. And I was like dying laughing. So I was like, that was my thought exactly. Like, this, this is a sign of true friendship, is that Julia saw this book and knew I would like it, but also knew the exact specific reason why I would want to be an indexer. Yes, but we'll get into that later on in the episode about my potential life journey pivots. Small critiques on the reading experience. You have alluded to the use of Middle English spelling and grammar in many quotations.
Too many.
If you're not familiar, listeners, with like the kind of like the progression of the English language, we kind of just like retroactively put labels on certain time periods of it because there was a couple major shifts in like how English was spoken and later how it was written.
The great vowel shift.
Yes. Look into it. It's another great niche topic.
Yeah.
If you like indexes, wow, get excited. The great vowel shift. So Middle English is, if you think of like Geoffrey Chaucer was the example Julia gave. If you try to read it in the original, you're like struggling. You're like, mm-hmm. I know this, but I don't. It's similar to me like hearing someone speak Spanglish, where I like kind of know Spanish, but not really. But I also know English and I get most of it, but I'm also like, wait, what? But like even more difficult than that is what I feel like reading Middle English is. And our man Duncan, he did many great things in this book. But one is that he has way too much faith in his readers. Mm-hmm. He's writing for a general audience. And occasionally he translates the Middle English, especially when the grammar is really funky and very different than how we speak today. But most of the time he does it. And you're just like, what is this, dude? This is a very long quotation and like a version of our language I cannot read.
Try reading it out loud, because often they were just making shit up with the spelling as they went along. And so if you try and read it out loud, it'll sound like you're doing English with an accent, and your brain will kind of know what to do with the sounds more than the spelling. Like if you literally just use like the phonics and just kind of like sound it out.
Here's one example where he's trying to even quote like a joke, which is even harder to do in language that I cannot quite read. It's probably going to sound fine, like you said, when you read it. Calvin in his chamber 5 years taught a nun till she was great with gospel and swoln with a son. Sounds pretty dece. But when you look at it on the page, till is spelled T-Y-L-L, and like swollen is like S-W-O-L-N-E, and nun is N-O-N-N-E, and son is S-O-N-N-E. Years is Y-E-R-E-S, so...
That's why I'm saying you read it out loud, because if you're just pronouncing things phonetically, like they used to just make up spelling based on phonics.
Okay, well, I should have talked with you before I read this because I was getting real angry.
But the problem is that was not communicated to you, the reader, from our good friend Duncan. That was communicated to you by me just now. So that didn't help you at all.
Another minor beef I have is that Duncan loves to bring in some literary references from fiction, and he likes to explain to you the entire plot. And yeah, that's not always necessary for the example. Also not great when he's spoiling the plot to a murder mystery, which is, you know, specifically something you want to enjoy for the plot. But those are minor critiques overall. I otherwise enjoyed the book. I thought it was a very nice length for a book of this topic. It got me very excited about indexes, and I am excited to talk about them today with you.
Yay! Okay, who is Duncan, our old
Duncan
pal?
Is a man of mystery. Just kidding. He's just not quite on the internet except for Twitter, and I did not want to make an X account because I have gotten rid of mine. Basically, he is Dennis Duncan is a British author and academic. He is currently a lecturer at the University College London. His research interests include book history, translation, and avant-garde literature, particularly some French groups. I believe his translation work is mainly English and French translation. The one tweet I could see without creating an account alluded to his family. He lives with his family in London. A little bit of his background academically, Duncan studied English at Manchester University, completed a PhD at Birkbeck, which is now part of the University of London, where he taught for a while. And he did a fellowship, postdoc at the Bodleian Library, Oxford. And then he had to, you know, complete the Oxbridge experience and was a fellow over at Cambridge for joining UCL in 2019.
Oh, that's pretty recent.
Yeah, relatively recent. And this book actually came out, I believe, in 22.
I'm not going to lie. I was imagining that this man was about 65 to 70 years old.
Oh no, he very much looks like in his maybe early 40s.
Oh wow.
On his book cover. Maybe late 30s. Sorry, Duncan, if you're listening and I got that wrong. But he's a young chap. Yeah, so it was originally published in 2021 in the UK and then came out the next year, 2022, in the US, and was named in New York Times 100 Notable Books and a bunch of other end of year lists. I think it was just like a fun bookish nonfiction that a lot of literary folks wanted to add to their reading list because it is also just a delight. He's published a lot academically, and I'm not going to go into all of that, but one notable publication I will mention is Book Parts, which is a essay collection, or I guess academic collection, that Duncan edited along with Adam Smith, and it is a collection of chapters about the different parts of books. So, introductions, dust jackets, tables of contents, end leaves, blurbs. They brought in a bunch of authors to write each one. And of course, our man Duncan wrote the chapter on indexes.
Wow. Oh, that's kind of fun.
Yeah. And he does a lot of, outside of his academic writing, he does a lot of general reader writing as far as for mainstream publications, and writes about a lot of the topics that kind of weave into indexes, which is how we share knowledge and how it's evolved and our cultural panic attacks we have when new technology comes out. So those are some of the things he talks about and writes about outside of academia as well.
Okay, for my summary, I'm just going to walk us through the table of contents, because you just need to know what's in this book. It starts off talking about alphabetical order. The craziest thing I think I may have learned in this book that is obvious when you say it out loud, but feels so bizarre to think about, is that alphabetical order had to be invented. It was like the alphabet had to be invented, and then some long time later, someone had to think, like, you know, this like randomly organized collection of all the letters and symbols we use to make sounds? What if we used that arbitrary order as a means of sorting things in our like homes of knowledge? It's really random, you know? Anyway, so that came first. And then we have, there's multiple indexes that get kind of invented at the same time through the church. So obviously, anytime you're talking about the history of creation of communication technology or ideas or any kind of reading or thought period in Western Europe, it's going through the Catholic Church. That's just, there's only one channel, there's only one river, and all of our knowledge went through it, unfortunately. So that's where the index evolved from, was just like, wow, the Bible is so long. I don't want to read the whole thing to find the thing I need to cite for my sermon, etc. Or like trying to learn the Bible. And then page numbers. That's another thing.
Another invention.
Page numbers had to be invented. Putting numbers on pages had to be someone's idea. And that sort of evolved alongside the invention of the printing press. Because when you don't have these massive illuminated manuscripts that sort of, you know, each page is like three sentences or whatever, you know, you have mass printing and everyone has potentially different copies, like everyone needs to be able to find the same page in order to use an index. So then the next chapter is the bah humbug, the kids are stupid because they use indexes chapter. Yeah, well, we will get into that for sure. And then there's a fun little side tangent. It feels like a side tangent, but it's also like,
it's one of the best parts of the book.
One of the best parts of the book, hands down, is the comedy and satire indexes of like the 18th century, where all the rich boys were just having fun making fun of each other in indexes. It was like, you know, publication humor, you know, the original Comedy Central or something, like where it's like, you know, spoofing. And then a chapter about indexing fiction and how it just doesn't work. And sort of we get to watch the evolution of the novel. Because again, the novel, this is something we talk about in one of our archived episodes, so you're gonna have to become a member in order to listen to it, but we did spend a good chunk of time talking about this. The novel is also invented. The idea that you would write made up stuff in a book and then other people would read it? Bonkers. Like, why would you do that? Why would you... And the delineation between real and not real. Anyway, so the not real stuff, indexes just don't work. Same thing with poetry. Trying to do indexes for not real stuff, for some reason, doesn't work. There's a chapter on that. Then we have, there was a period where a lot of people were transitioning into the modern age. We've, you know, got more global communication. And there was this ambition to create a universal index where each library would kind of like, in the world, would like try to index a particular topic. It didn't go very well. And then the last like main chapter is the book index in the age of search. And this is not exactly what I thought it was. I thought this would be all about Google. It was mainly about integrating tech into the index making process and then integrating indexes into technology a little bit. So there's a bit about the way that Google is technically just like a massive index of the internet. We're going to talk about that. This was the chapter for me where I was like, oh, this is a whole book right here. Like, we need to spend more time here. So that's what we're going to do today. So that's it. There's a preface and a little extra bit at the end. So let's get into it. Kind of going to take the biggest themes that we saw in order that they appear in the book.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it. We liked the order he presented information. We will follow along.
Yes.
I also, like you, thought the invention of the alphabet, like alphabetizing things, was super fascinating. There were like little tidbits in there that I knew, like there's a chapter or multiple chapters of the Bible.
Leviticus.
Lamentations.
Lamentations. The Book of Lamentations is an acrostic poem. That blew my brain. I was like, oh, so that's why Lamentations is always included in the Songs and Poetry and Proverbs section.
Yeah, because like each section starts with like the next alphabetical letter of the Hebrew alphabet, which I think I knew. Like when I read it, I wasn't surprised. I was like, oh yeah, I kind of forgot about that. It was interesting to think about how, you know, this tool for learning, right? At some point, someone said, let's teach the letters in this order. I'm sure it wasn't like uniform right away. But with English, the English alphabet, you know, A, B, C, D, E, like at some point someone's like, this makes sense for teaching the children. And eventually people started connecting it as like a way to maybe organize information. And you had to explain it. So I pulled a passage because I thought it was kind of bonkers.
Oh, yeah.
Of how, dear reader, you may learn to read an alphabetical index. This is by Robert Caudry. This is for his Table Alphabetical, which I think had a different name, but that's what everyone calls it because it was the first alphabetical table that we have record of. If thou be desirous, gentle reader, rightly and readily to understand and to profit by this table and such like, then thou must learn the alphabet. To wit, the order of the letters as they stand, perfectly, without book, and where every letter standeth as, for example, B near the beginning, N about the middlest, and T toward the end. Now, if the word which thou art desirous to find begin with A, then look in the beginning of this table. But if with V, look towards the end. Again, if thy word begin with CA, look at the beginning of the letter C. But if with CU, then look toward the end of the letter, and so of all the rest, etc.
Absolutely ridiculous. It's so wordy. Like, that's a whole page by itself. Like, just...
He might have invented the alphabetical table, but he did not invent succinctness.
No, he most certainly did not. Yeah, I absolutely loved that. That tickled me so much because it's this style of like telling something to a friend, but it's like kind of poetic in and of itself and so wordy, which like is the absolute antithesis of like organizing things in an alphabetical table, but also like, there's a much shorter way to explain that. It's like he had to remind people the order of the letters first and then explain that he's organizing it. Like he never says the items in this table are organized in the order of the alphabet. He says, remember your letters. And then if it starts with B, it'll be towards the beginning. And if it starts with N, it'll be towards the middle. And just starts immediately goes into giving examples. We got it. I don't know. I
think it's funny, too, because he gives examples, but it's not like he writes the alphabet out and is like, as a reminder, this is the order that we are using here. Here you go. It's like, for example, V towards the end. You're like, okay, V and all the other ones at the end. Thank you. They're very helpful. But yeah.
So I also,
in this chapter, found it interesting, like, and it was kind of a precursor of a lot of what this book is about, is like, the pushback and discourse when anyone tries to do something new. And now we think of the alphabet as a very helpful, arbitrary thing. Like, for example, we have a classroom of students. We want them to stand in the same order every day so it's easy to find them and find their little cubbies instead of being like, who's, I don't know, taller or faster or like, I like this student more, I'll put them here. We default to alphabet. And it's like, that is the arbitrary way of things. This is the name you were given,
yeah.
And that is just where you stand. That is where you sit.
We see it as like not relating to any value about you as a person. It's just like, this is an objective order that exists and no one can be offended by us arranging you in this way. No, that's such a good point because it like, now we ascribe objectivity to it or arbitrariness, as you're saying. But in the past, like, people would have argued about whether or not it was a good thing.
Because there was, like, some debate that it was, like, why would you use an arbitrary thing? Creating, for example, you mentioned these, like, kind of collections of, like, a prototype of an index, kind of, like, you want to teach a sermon on a topic on trust. Here's all these passages about trust in the Bible. You want a topic on the Holy Spirit. He has all the passages on the Holy Spirit. And, you know, one of these collectors and organizers of this information is like, there are topics that are more important than others. Like, I am giving you my wisdom in my writing. Like, I made a choice of which order these go in, and that's very important to me.
Yeah.
Whereas the index kind of levels it. It's not about importance of topic. It is just about finding in an arbitrary order that we can, like, agree to, ascribe to, not have to teach.
You can almost track, like, where we switched from valuing particular religious ideals or the experience of a particular philosopher or something, where we switched from valuing that. Instead, now, like, efficiency and ease are, like, more valuable. It's more important that as many people as possible be able to access this information as quickly as possible. That is more important. The sort of careful organizational hand of a particular person's value system who is maybe an expert in their field and wants to arrange it in a certain way. At, like, obviously, there are instances where we do want that more than the alphabetical. But I think it's just interesting that, like, you can see that in so many places in how the world is run now, where, like, efficiency is considered, quote-unquote, objective, is considered, oh, of course, that's better. Ease is considered, of course, that's better. When that hasn't always been the case, especially with reading and learning and communication.
One of my other, like, early in the book things, it's almost like a side note because it's not even the main focus of the section, but there was a shift when reading was done out loud
and yes! when it was
done silently, right?
Yeah.
Like, Duncan cites this historian who writes, like, in the Middle Ages, one generally read by speaking with one's lips, at least in a whisper, and consequently hearing the phrases that the eye sees. So reading was, like, much more connected to, like, recitation and, like, you know, the words on the page was just to aid you in being able to hear the words without having to memorize them. But there was, like, a shift. It was this guy Ambrose, Bishop of Milan, and Augustine would, like, comment on him of how he was very different. Quote, his eyes would scan over the page and his heart would scrutinize their meaning, yet his voice and tongue remained silent. And that was another thing that was like, right, we didn't just create writing systems and then immediately read silently to ourselves.
Yeah.
That was like a developed thing that happened later.
It's so fascinating. I feel like so much of what this book did for me is less about, like, obviously there's so many fun facts, but it's less about, for me and my experience, the index itself. I think for you, there is a big part of it where it's just like, oh my God, indexes. Oh my God, sorting. But for me, what I really loved about this book was it emphasized the, like, madeness and, like, materiality of, like, all of the things we just assume this is how we've always done it because we've done it for, like, you know, hundreds of years. But the way that, like, things have to be made and they are made in context with a certain set of value systems and whatever. And, like, duh, right? But sometimes you have to be reminded of that.
Mm-hmm.
And also, when things are made, they are made for the people who are living at that time, who are doing something else. Right? So, like, writing and reading was invented when people purely lived in an oral tradition, right? So, no matter where writing was invented, before that, writing didn't exist. So, they were just organizing things orally somehow. It was created to serve a purpose for the people that existed at that point. They aren't imagining us 2,000 years later being like, oh, there's gonna be these girls who have walls covered in books and they're gonna every week sit down and spend 2 hours talking about one of them. That's not what they're making writing for, right? They're making writing for the people who are like, I'm getting old and I have to continue reciting all of Homer every day and I would like to keep my job and I can't remember the one part with all the names of everyone who died. Can we write this down? Is there a place we could put this so I could see it? But because something is new and something is made in a context where people don't use it and now suddenly some people do, there is going to be pushback. There's going to be adjustments to even something so simple, something that seems so basic as like alphabetical organization, or something that we all kind of universally value at this point are kind of like, ah, man, we should do more of, which is writing. You know, it's something that I think you mentioned and that Duncan brings back a lot. A common motif throughout all of this book is that, like, there's going to be that pushback and, you know, the younger people coming up who didn't know the old way of doing things are just going to take on this new technology and just run with it. And it's going to become something totally new. And so writing's just going to become normal, or using an index at the end of a book to help you, like, find stuff is just going to become normal. But the people who had to do things the hard way, the old people, are going to be like, kids these days are so dumb. They can't remember anything. They have to write it down. Or kids these days refuse to read. They just skim through the index and claim that they've read the book. Which, like, don't we all know a guy like that? Because it's always
It's like, it feels never ending. And I feel like Duncan does a really great job of illustrating this, of, you know, the first indices coming out, you know, they're becoming more popular and everyone's like, oh man, it's kind of like the back in my day. It's like back in my day, yes, we actually had to read the whole book. Like, we went to college, or I guess university, and we had to read everything. That's what knowledge is reading everything and not just skimming the index. And Duncan brings it back to, like, Aristotle, when they were like, oh, you wrote down this speech you heard so you'd remember it? Like, what are we coming to these days that people can't even remember things? They have to rely on writing. And it's like just this ongoing evolution. I think how when we were probably like in middle school, high school, we were in the peak beginnings of like, don't use Wikipedia as a source. Like, Wikipedia is not good. And like, it was just kind of like this, oh, scary thing. Like, don't use Wikipedia. Anyone can edit it. It could be wrong. And then it's like, okay, that was an extreme overreaction. The real answer is don't cite Wikipedia because it's not a first or secondary source, but it's super helpful. Mm-hmm. And like, I think when I was in college and started using it as, I was just trying to find a research topic for a class freshman year. And I just did like a Wikipedia rabbit hole. I had to pick someone, a medieval writer from a specific period, and I just kind of poked around and like followed different Wikipedia rabbit holes and just got a lay of the land. And so when I was ready to be like, okay, this piece is my topic, I'm going to do the hagiography of Hildegard of Bingen, and here we go. Uh-huh. And then I had like a starting place. I had like some knowledge to work with, so I could go to the library, use an index, mm-hmm, find the chapters, go find translations of the original work, and you know, off I was on my research journey. It was about how to use the tool to complement the end goal of gathering knowledge and being able to synthesize and analyze and produce original work about it. And it makes me think of a lot of conversations we have about AI these days, of like the extreme reaction of like, it is absolutely evil, there's nothing good that can come from it, and we should all stay away, versus like, maybe we should understand how it could be used and not tell students like, you are incompetent if you think that this is going to get you through, instead of like, how about we talk about how to use tools to get us where we want to go. Still be critical, still be like, let's look into what's happening here, in the same way that Wikipedia took off. I think in many ways that other websites, you're like, yeah, maybe not just like rando blog about medieval time period is going to be helpful to me, but Wikipedia has set some standards for itself. It's been transparent in certain ways. It's given us a sense of who they are as a entity and what it could be used for, not just like grabbing every single tool without any critical eye.
We're going to see whether, when and how people actually use this tool, right? Because I think something we see in this book is kind of the in-between phases of invention. When a society has not fully decided what a tool is going to be used for and what place it will have in their particular society, there's these kind of in-between phases where people are like trying things out, or obviously the first thing people start doing with it is making jokes and making porn. Same thing with the index. So there, you know, I think AI public, the general public has not yet landed on where this tool fits into our, because it's here now. I don't know. What I don't enjoy is that every single goddamn time I want to use some piece of software, they like shove their own version of AI in my face. It is created by people with a particular perspective. This is something he talks about with indexes a lot in the book, is that like any kind of tool is created by a person or a group of people with a particular goal, with certain values, with certain ideas. Like all of the major companies are freaking out thinking they're gonna lose money if they don't make some shitty version of ChatGPT and force you to buy it. Don't make a shitty version of ChatGPT and make me spend more money on a thing I don't want. I can do this myself. It's very easy. Like, you know, leave, I don't know. That's where I get frustrated. But I think there will be kind of a sifting and a settling of this particular tool where we figure out, because clearly there is a use for it that the general public wants, and it will land somewhere.
And I do think in this similar way that, right, like we get this whole bit of Duncan's book about why the index doesn't work for fiction. Yes. I think we're going to find why AI didn't work in like 17 different scenarios where it was like shoved in there. Like, I know AI gets better and there's room for improvement, but I get annoyed lately when my Google results, the AI portion is at the top.
Oh my god.
And I've been doing some search for some like help articles for an application, software application we're using at work. The AI results are always like cherry picking in a way that makes it sound like, oh, that sounds like an easy thing to do. Try to click the link to find the actual help article, and the help article actually says something different. It's like, it's used all the words, but it has cut out the key part of like, well, you still need to do steps A through T, but yes, step U, V, X is available. Alphabet, forgot it in this moment. But anyways, I think there'll be things like that where we're like, yeah, indexing fiction doesn't really work in the same way. It's like, yeah, we thought AI would be a good application here, but it's not. I think our ancestors will look back and be like, dear Lord, I'm sure they'll use a better word than AI in the future. You know, their tools are so rudimentary and, oh my gosh, so inefficient and like, oh, why? But that's how communication and technology progresses and changes.
Duncan spends a long time emphasizing the person behind an index, the indexer, as well as the indexees, right? The people using the indexes. The indices, I guess is what you're supposed to say, that he has this quotation, just as every translation bears the trace of the translator, every index is inevitably haunted by its indexer, because it's a, you know, someone putting together, reading a text, and then putting together what in their mind is going to be the most useful for these imaginary people, these imaginary future readers. What they're going to want out of this book. What are they going to be looking for? What keywords, what concepts are they going to be wanting to find when they come back to this book? And so you have to, it's a work of empathy. It's a work of imagination. A lot of a deep knowledge of the text itself, of like what's actually in it and how the ideas relate to each other. And Duncan, I think, sort of lands in a similar place that we have, where it's like, it's not the tool, it's how you use it. Computers can't quite do all the indexing. They're very good at the boring stuff, like alphabetizing every single word in the entire book for you or something like that, right? But you have to, there has to be some degree of empathy and imagination in order to put together an index for a particular audience.
So, of course, I can't just read about people who index. I must try my hand at indexing. Of course. I went and downloaded Syndex, which, as Duncan explained in a later part of the book, was developed in 1986. It is an older software. Nothing flashy, but it does the job. And I learned that it was made free by the original developer and a team of quote, interested indexers who wanted to make this tool available. It looks like software I used in the early 2000s when I was learning how to use a computer, but it does the job. I like opened up the manual that was like 95 pages long.
Oh my God.
To like try to learn how to use it. It's a lot of like keystrokes, but I can see how you can get really speedy at this and have like one window up of your source text. You can also work on multiple indices or indexes at the same time. So if you're indexing, we're talking generally about like back of the book index that's like about the whole book, but you might separate it out and do like an index of places, an index of proper nouns, or an index of whatever subtopics. So you could get multiple index windows going, you create different items. And then the stupidest part is I couldn't get mine to sort. I was like, I can't get this formatted. What am I going on? I literally just had to close my, like, I had the little window open for like a new entry. Mm. Just had to close that window. And then it all went magic. And it like, you know, I had 7 different pages that used the same heading and they all like bundled up together. And I could do alphabetize. I could like switch the order to be like order of the book. So I could like skim and see where I missed anything. And our dear listeners, I realize I didn't say this part, but I was using Julia's master's thesis. I was like, what's something that doesn't have an index that I've read before and isn't entirely too long? Which was also silly because I've never done it before. So I spent like an hour and a half and I got through the first chapter of her thesis. So the first like 16 pages. I didn't think it would be doable in one sitting. I just thought I'd do more than one chapter in one sitting. But I think that exercise was the most eye-opening. Like, I definitely was on board with Duncan. I was like, oh, yeah, like, the hand of the indexer making these choices is very evident. He gives a lot of examples of when people disagreed with the source text. And so they're, you know, indexing with some snark.
Yeah.
Yeah, I felt myself with this little brain teaser of a project trying to think of, like, what is the hierarchy of headings and subheadings and, you know, what might a reader be looking for? And, like, this is the word the author used, but it really fits under this other category. But some people might be looking for that word specifically. So maybe it should be its own. So I only got like a rough draft version going. And I imagine, you know, obviously the professionals have their way of doing things and they're not making those decisions for the first time every time they index. It was fascinating.
You sent it to me, your draft of like the index of the first chapter. And I was very tickled by some of them. But what I was stuck on was like, what do you do when the author is trying not to be repetitive? And so they just have several, you know, they have like 2 or 3 ways of saying like basically the same thing. Or like functionally, they should all be under the same heading. Maybe you have separate listings, but they should all be under the same main heading or something like that. You just have to like know which, because sometimes 2 terms will look extremely similar and you cannot conflate the 2 because they are extremely different. And sometimes it's like, oh yeah, that's just another way of saying this. And then you can combine them. And so it's like, you have to really know, and it would be, have to be so collaborative with like multiple iterations to like put together something that like really works for the readers of that book.
And I can totally see why indexers specialize in certain topics. I actually was on the society, I don't remember the exact name of it. I'll find it and link it in the show notes. It's whatever American Society of Indexers there are. Many professional indexers are part of society and they're listed under their topics. Wow. So it's like, I'm a publisher. I need an indexer who is knowledgeable about like East Asian history of the 19th century or something like that. Wow. Maybe not that niche, but like, fairly niche topics you can click in. At the time I was looking, none of the indexers in the society had queer history as one of their topics. And I'm like, is this my entry point?
Intriguing. Yeah.
I'm sure there are indexers who specialize in that. They just may not be listed on this website.
Also probably newer.
Yeah. And I mean, you think of, you know, especially in the queer community, like words and labels and identities, like there's a lot of really specific word usage, but there's also been so much evolution of certain terms. So when you're thinking about the reader, what term might they be looking for that maybe the author has used a different term for or chosen to refer to it differently, or especially when you're talking about history, you know, something like the term transsexual would have been really common in a certain period of history that you might be writing about that wouldn't necessarily be the term we'd use today, and like how to navigate that, those choices. And so within minutes, I was like, oh, I completely understand the indexers making a lot of decisions. The easiest was when you named a proper noun, and I was like, Zoom, page 5. Zoom, page 6. Zoom, figure 1.
You also cited our dear friend Natasha made graphic for me, and you proper cited noun. Her, and I was like, yes, like, look at
last name common Natasha, figure 1.
Yes.
I can see why the very basic index of just proper nouns is used, because it is easier, it is probably cheaper, it is probably something you can do without paying an indexer, but also it drives me crazy when I pick up a book that I'm like, ooh, nice, let me find something. And you're like, okay, well, this index just lists the names of all the people they cited and like the historical figures they mentioned and like some place names. But like, I'm trying to get to the topics. Like, what is this book about?
And that requires niche knowledge.
Yeah, it requires niche knowledge.
Niche knowledge.
Niche knowledge. And really digging in and figuring out what's going on. We probably cut this out, but Julia just gave me permission to give my rant on cookbooks. So here we go. When I pick up a cookbook, I like to look at the pictures. I like to flip through the titles and be inspired. But what I really want is to look at the index and be like, I have zucchini in the fridge. What can I make with zucchini? I have so many cookbooks on my shelf that have the most useless indexes at the back where it just names like all the recipes, or like it only includes the ingredient if it's in the title of a recipe, not in like the usage of a recipe. Or like it's maybe categorized, and I can see, again, the reader is coming with different needs. Maybe it's like, here's all the soups, can be helpful. But also a lot of table of contents will do that for you, you know, depending on how the cookbook is already organized. If the cookbook already has a section on vegetable mains, I don't really feel the need to have a part of the index that's really dedicated to vegetable mains if you weren't also giving me
the vegetables.
So maybe that'll be my niche topic as an indexer, just out of pure spite. I'll just be like a guerrilla indexer. I'll make an index for like some of my favorite cookbooks that I think have pretty shitty indexes, and then I'll print it out on just like normal printer paper and like run around the library and like the used bookstore and like even the new bookstore, and just shove these new indexes into the back with maybe a little flyer, and people can hire me. But probably the people buying the cookbooks aren't the people hiring cookbook indexers.
I don't know. A competitor might be sneaking a peek at someone's latest book, and they go, oh, wow.
This is a so useful index. Look at what I can use my zucchini on. So, Julia, we gave a little teaser of some of our favorite, like, comedy and satire indexes of the 1700s.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about those?
If we're talking about an index as a tool that should actually work for people, it's kind of like UX for books, you know? It's like purposeful design, you know what I mean? The people who invent things are often frustrated by how people end up actually using it. They just can't really control it. And one of the things that always ends up happening is people find a way to make, like, fart jokes and stuff with it. You know what I mean? Like, there's no resisting it. You can't control it. Like, someone is going to make an index somewhere where they use the entire index to, like, tell their best friend or their mortal enemy, fuck off. People are going to do it. You know, he keeps talking about the humanity of indexes, but this was a part that really brought that home for me. Like, I think my favorite one was the one where it was basically a TLDR for people who couldn't read. And it was like, there was this beef going on and they were passing out flyers of indexes, but they had pictures with like captions and like headers of like the finer points. Like it claimed to be an index. It was a comedy index and it was arranged like an index, but then it had pictures to pass out to like your common folks who couldn't read so that they could be in on the drama. And I was so tickled by that. That was so hilarious. I'm sure really pissed off, you know, book purists everywhere So they're like, this isn't a real index. You are mocking the art, or you are mocking literature or the source material or whatever. But you can't really be too precious with that kind of thing. Let people use it for dumb shit. So you have the physical copy of the book because I mailed it to you. So I'm going to leave you for the examples.
One example, there was some literary beef between one writer who translated a work and another writer that was like, your translation's shit and here's all the reasons why. And then the buddies of the original like translator guy was like, we support our friend. Let's write a pamphlet destroying this other guy who is really just pointing out the inaccuracies of the first guy's work. They included an index, a short account of Dr. Bentley by way of index, and includes things such as his egregious dullness, pages 75, 106, 119, 135, etc. His pedantry from page 93 to 99, 144 to 16. His appeal to foreigners, which apparently was a dig. And his familiar acquaintance with books that he never saw. Pages 75, 96, etc.
Oh, so good.
I thought that was a delight. I also really enjoyed the story of a Whig in the British political party wrote a history, like his definitive a history of England.
So if you can imagine, Whigs were even further right than Tories writing. These are the landowning gentry folks. You know, barf. He was writing some blah-de-blah, the definitive history of, you know, blah in his, you know, spare time, because he probably didn't have anything else to do.
Yeah, so one of the examples is, like, this passage where the author is basically explaining this guy and his accomplice were brought before the bar and asked, you know, why execution should not be awarded against them in regard. They stood attainted by outlawry of high treason for conspiring to the death of King Charles II. Basically, like, why should we not kill you?
You threatened the king, why should we let you live?
Yeah, and having nothing to say that could avail them, the court made a rule, should be executed on the Friday following, and accordingly, they were hanged. Of course, the indexer who was hired to do this, index for this book, was of a very different political persuasion and really very much did not like this account of history. And so his index, however, gives it as this. Nelthrop Richard, which is the person in the story. A lawyer hanged without a trial in King James's time. You know, giving his Tory take on it is like, this was, you know, outrage that there wasn't, you know, they were denied a proper trial and hung for crimes that they were not given a chance to have a full account for. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that is less like tongue-in-cheek, we're making like a snarky index. More of a, this is a serious book that there was some mismatch in who got hired to write the index. And it led a later politician in Britain to say, quote, let no Tory index my history. Such a great line.
It's such a great line because it's like, I don't want people who disagree with me interpreting what I have to say or interpreting what happened in a different way than I interpret it. I want my way of seeing to be the only way of seeing. Because an index is an interpretation, right? We keep talking about imagination, self-expression, like the humanity behind the tool and how it's used. That's another very human part of it, is that it is like, it's an interpretation of the text that could come from a different perspective than the original author. Like, that's very fascinating. You know, I think we now, if you think about indexes at all, you do think of them as this, like, alphabetizing kind of objective thing. It's just like, here's all the stuff that's in this book, you know? But no, it has an agenda. It has a point of view. It has a target audience. It seems like for a while, the index was kind of a symbol of counterculture, of cultural commentary, of like that was their daily show, was they would pass around satirical indexes. You know what I mean? Like that was how they critiqued political power or people who were too full of themselves. You know what I mean?
Which honestly sounds like a delight. Like if someone handed me like a list of memes all like referencing like the, you know, Shakespeare canon, I'd be like, this is hilarious. Like in such a condensed form. You know, punchline after punchline. It's a good time.
I literally wrote in the margins next to the section of comedy indexes that they are like the original subtweet. You're like retweeting and the original text is there. Your text is commentary on the original text and people can see both. And there's like comedy in the contrast. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was like, we still do this. Like, we have not changed as human beings.
Yeah, and in a way, we've all kind of become our own indexers. And
dude, yeah.
And, like, the more literal way of, like, hashtags, right? Like, that was using a search function where you self-described where you were trying to, like, categorize your content. You're mm-hmm. like, hashtag Flashback Friday. If you're looking for Flashback Friday, click on it and find all the options. And you right. have your index and you can click in and read everyone's posts and see their pictures. And we have become these, created our own language around hashtagging as well, whether it's to formalize a movement to get people on the same page. Even just group stuff for ourselves, you know, people create hashtags for their wedding. It's not supposed to be, you know, this huge thing for everyone to get to, but all their wedding guests can like click and see the photos, or the people getting married can see all the options of photos that people took throughout the day. So we have been able to create our own indexes on the internet, the tools created, as well as just like we have adapted to search. Like we have figured out how to look up the thing we need, and our search tools have gotten better that we can be like, you know, I think Duncan gives some specific examples of like, you could write this, Google knows enough from its index of the internet to know what context you mean. Mm-hmm. Like the word bass or bass is spelled the same, but in a certain context, it means fish. In a certain context, it means guitar, or it could mean something else. You know, there's even more meanings to that term.
The other example he gave was like, ask Jeeves, to help people transition into the idea of like a universal index in a way. Ask Jeeves, it was like, oh, this is a person, a librarian, where you are going in and typing in a full sentence. And he is responding like a person and providing all those resources you need. So you would use a full sentence like, how do I know when water is boiling? You use a whole sentence with a question mark. And Ask Jeeves would be like, great question. Here's some information that might be helpful for you, kind sir. It's like a little butler. Whereas like now we just type in water boil or something and yeah. it'll the first result will be like water boils at this temperature, Celsius and Fahrenheit. We have so adapted all of our lives to extreme searchability. Like we're so used to like all knowledge in existence being indexed on the internet. That's basically what the internet is. It's like tons and tons of information with this massive index. To Google something is to use the index of the internet. Because we're so findable by everybody in the world, which is a terrifying thought that like anyone in the world could see something you made. Like if someone happened to stumble upon, you gave the example of a wedding hashtag, right? That's not private. No one's looking for it necessarily, but if a random stranger on the other side of the world found it, they could just like scroll through all your wedding pictures.
I mean, that's me. I have done that.
Right. Yes. Because we love being nosy. We're human beings. We then try to adapt how we talk and our content in order to sort of operate within a smaller index so that you are not findable. There's this term in digital anthropology called scalable sociality, which is basically that the internet is so massive in a way that our brains can't really handle. And so we like create boundaries, we create barriers to try and like make ourselves visible to certain audiences. And one of the ways we do that is by kind of self-indexing, keywording ourselves, and choosing, self-selecting which search terms, which tools we want to be seen by. Same thing with like SEO, right? Search engine optimization is like basically if you started with an index and writing a book based on the index so that you use the index terms as much as possible so that people can find all the index items in your book, which is kind of bananas if you think about it.
It's why the writing isn't always great.
Yeah.
But it is effective.
Yeah. So I could talk about that for like forever, because I find that so fascinating, the way that we have kind of wrapped our lives around like the fact that all information and every single human is like indexed
And it is always startling to me when I stumble upon something that there is just nothing on the internet about, where, like, I forget the example specifically, but there was a time that I'd heard a phrase used, multiple people in the conversation seemed to know what it meant, and later I was like, what did they mean by that? It was like some sort of slang phrase, and I Googled it, and I like could not find it. Oh, I remember the example. It was, I've heard several people in Denver, where I live now, use, oh, it was a type 1 and kind of fun. It was a type 2 kind of fun. And I'm like, what does that mean? And my partner didn't know. And he's like, I mean, I hear people use it, but I don't really know what it means. And if you Google it, all it brings up is like how to have an active social life with type 2 diabetes. And like,
right,
yes. It's like not getting at what I need. And so, yeah, I was like, oh, there are limits to the internet. Like, I didn't know where to look for this. And eventually I just came up in conversation with someone else. Like, can you explain what that means? So at least in the Denver area, a type 1 fun is, it was fun while I was doing it and it's fun to talk about. Type 2 fun is, wasn't necessarily fun while it was happening, but it is a fun story to tell.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And the friends we had dinner with last night mentioned type 3 fun, which as a group, we collectively figured out what that definition meant and where the lines were. But it's basically, it sounds like it should have been fun, but it wasn't fun while it was happening. And it is still not fun to tell the story. Like, I'm sure if I search certain places, I'd find people using it in context, yes. But I'm not going to find, like, even like Urban Dictionary, which is generally helpful for some of these kind of slang questions, didn't necessarily have it, and not always in the regional context that you're using it, or the group specific context, not necessarily location dependent, but like.
But that's what slang is for. That's what, like, abbreviations are for. That's what acronyms are for. They're for defining, like, in-group and out-group and creating, like, boundaries of, like, who can understand us and who can't. We all kind of do it naturally, but, like, it's now kind of on a global scale, which is what I find so fascinating. And I think also why language has to evolve so fast, because it gets picked up so fast. If you think about, like, the word demure, it was in her little circle. It was everywhere. 2 days later, it was then on, like, the vice president's Instagram, and now it's gone. A term is dead when they have found it, right? And everyone has a different definition for who they is, but it's usually, like, corporations, politicians, people in power who are using it to be like, what's up, fellow kids? You know, trying to be relatable. If your youth pastor is saying demure, it's over. But it's over because it has crossed over that boundary that it was designed to create. And so now it's not usable as an in-group term.
So, in general, the nexuses are cool. We're having a fun time. There's a lot more history in this book that we didn't even get to. William Poole is a fascinating character. The attempts to create a universal index, also fascinating. The massive projects that different people have taken on at different times, whether it was a fruitful endeavor or just a really massive thing that we now have an example of because it past the test of time, was really enjoyable to read about. And I do agree with you, the book made me think about a lot of the modern implications of the index that this book only briefly touched on, but it was covering a lot of ground to start at, you know, the beginning of alphabetizing to get all the way to modern day. But really enjoyed it. I have mentioned in passing when people have been like, oh, what are you reading lately? I'm like, oh, I'm reading Index, a history of the, and they're like, what? And yes. I'm like, it's a great book. It's about indexes, you know, at the back of the book. And everyone's like, cool. So I really appreciate you being as excited as I am to talk about this book. That's why book clubs are important.
Yes.
Gotta find your people.
We gotta support each other. I feel like I learned so much from this book, and it's like tied so well into my previous research in grad school, and it's making me think about a lot of things. And I feel like we as a friend pair, I was going to say friend group, we're two people. We as friends are going to be referencing things from this book for like forever. I'm calling it now. Like, we're definitely, and I'm going to have to call you because you have my copy.
Can you
like, Victoria, what did I write in the margins?
Well, thankfully there is a very helpful index. Very fun index at the back of this book, including a little flavor from the indexer herself, who added a little see also treasure hunt through the whole index. So for those who have enjoyed Index, what would you recommend they read or check out next?
Yeah, support your like open source nonprofit folks who are trying to document history as it's happening, like Wikipedia, like Internet Archive. We are in a time where as searchable and as visible as everything is, and we can find anything we want to know, the entire Nickelodeon catalog or MTV catalog can be deleted from existence with the click of a button and no one will ever be able to access it ever again. Make sure that you're supporting the people who are like collecting and documenting what's going on. I would also recommend this book that I haven't read yet, but it's been on my For You page so many times and I'm like, I know I would love it. It's called Filter World by Kyle, I believe, Chaika? I don't know what linguistic context that word comes from, so I'm guessing. It's about how algorithms flattened reality a little bit. But it's like this, I think, a darker side of everything we've been talking about, of like something that is filtered, some kind of tool that like filters everything for us. What does that do to our experience of reality? What about you?
So if you are interested in deep dives into niche topics, I recommend The Anthropocene Reviewed, the podcast by John Green. He also has a book, which I hear is very lovely, and I have not read it yet on my very long TBR, but looking forward to that. There is a newsletter about the internet that I find fascinating called Garbage Day. It is free to subscribe. There is a member option if you want to promote and support the team of two that I believe put together the newsletter. And it's just kind of like the garbage that's happening on the internet, as well as some philosophical reflections and thoughts on how technology is changing us and how we change technology. And it is one of my favorite newsletters to open in my inbox lately. I go through phases, and this one has stuck for a while. And lastly, what are you currently obsessed with? What's bringing you joy?
Three music discoveries that are new to me, but not super new to the world, I think. Doechii's new album? I have a blast with that one. Rachel Chinariri is alt-pop artist from London. I'm obsessed. It's, as a whole album, it's one of my favorites in a long time. And then very similarly, I just sent this to Victoria, I think last night, this artist Mustafa's new album called Dunya. The best way I can describe him is Muslim Sufjan Stevens. My favorite song from the album is called Gaza's Calling.
Yeah, when you sent it over, I put it on last night when I was doing the indexing. And I was like, this is a really great album. And also that is the most accurate description. Muslim Sufjan Stevens definitely has the vibe. So I got this little calendar off of Etsy. I wanted like a very tangible calendar for some like goal tracking, because sometimes I have this thought that I'm like very steady in progressing on some things I want to work on, but I actually do spend a lot of time like working towards my goals. And so I made my, you know, my little calendar to like record things and celebrate, because I love little celebrations when we do things we like. And it's just a very cute calendar. And it's like an intersection of my favorite things, which is postage stamps and like plants. So every month is a different fake postage stamp that is like of strawberries or mushrooms or leaves or whatever. That's very cute. Yeah, and our next episode we record will be after I've gone to like 3 concerts, so I'll have many updates, because I have an exciting month of music coming up.
That'll be fun. All right, we need to go to bed.
Yeah.
So we will sign off.
Until next time, happy reading.
Bye.
This has been an episode of Book Club with Julia and Victoria. A huge thank you to all of our members who keep the show going. You can also join the membership and support the show to receive special access to our film club, newsletters, and the archive of the first 50 episodes. You can find all that and more at buymeacoffee.com/bookclubwithjb. This episode was co-hosted and produced by myself, Victoria Bruick, along with Julia Clausen. Our music is composed by Greg Bruick. Our logo was designed by Gabby Febland. We want to know what you're reading and your bookish thoughts, so you can reach us at our website, bookclubwithjv.com, on Instagram at bookclubwithjv, or by leaving a review on Apple or Spotify. We'll catch you next time. Happy reading.